I am seven. The 29th of April 1960 to the 28th of April 1961. Over. I wanted to be a lion by Hardloader Droid. The train to Great Yarmouth is the most expensive train in the world, but it is also the fastest. The train to Great Yarmouth is the fastest, and it is also the shortest. I'm 7 years old at the time. My parents had just moved from Manchester to Brighton to start their life in Great Yarmouth. They had been married only 3 weeks before, so we were mostly without a word. I was just as lonely as anyone in the world. They bought a house in Old Horton Place, in Old Horton Street, between the shops, the factory and the concert hall. We had a lovely house in the back garden, with the three cars in the back and a bedroom that held a kitchen. My parents chose to live in the front garden, so we had to walk to school and to a small restaurant they had for breakfast. Our swimming pool was located just behind my bedroom. We had three women's shops in our garden. We didn't really have a tailor, though, and we wore the clothes we had. We still did. We did keep a decent collection of towels. This garden was pretty simple and cool. We had this great patch of mown grass in front of our garden, near the long oval fence. It wasn't a deep field, just a couple of bits of grass of various shapes and sizes, some for the animals and a few for us. From a young age, I knew I wanted to be a lion, but wouldn't have any small fenced-in areas on the lawn in front of my house. I wouldn't if I had a terrace, a huge shed, or a shed with a huge pool in the back. It was either this small little patch, that lovely patch of grass, or I would have a big woodland area or other undergrowth. My dad was a politician, a large man with a square jaw. He had a slight pompadour, but his face was serene. He had a great laugh and a great sense of humour, but he could be finicky, and everything was arranged according to plan. My dad put the table on the floor and all the chairs and blankets in the living room. He had two bed frames set up, a table with a cupboard underneath. My dad's favourite toys were a tin of beans and a tin of biscuits, and there was another tin on a string through a hole in the corner. He brought a little bag full of spoons and forks for each child. He had an ironing board and a table and chairs. He had a full range of fire extinguishers and candles. It was a lovely little room. We had a few things that were hanging in our house for family friends and family to play with. One was the skull of a nasty man with no hands. It was just, well, up there. Another was a type of candle made of rags, coloured and encrusted in snow. And the Christmas tree was full of coloured tinsel and felt and paper and paint. I came up with the concept of a Christmas tree, wishing for all kinds of things for the tree and how I would like it to be decorated. It was inevitable that the canopy would be decorated. That was the first aspect. The second element was there would be a sculpture on the trunk of the tree. This would be the centrepiece, a large, fascinating sculpture of a redoubtable quality by the renowned sculptor Ernest Ludwig Kirchner. The idea was that a friend who was the technician for the sculptor would come and bring him the outline of a small, chunky metal robot of some kind. I wanted it to look like a toy, but it had to be a giant. In my imagination, The robot would be walking with its arm above my tree. I would know it was there, but I could never tell whether it was I or it. It would have arms, but I could never tell which arms it was holding. No work was ever finished in all the trees. On one occasion, a group of children made fun of the fact there was no maple tree for them to look at. An hour later, a poor old farmer found out that a barrel of sap from a nearby maple tree had been used to decorate my tree. He paid for the trees and a vase of sunflowers. I learned that my fellow villagers were pleased with the successes of my scheme. It was the end of my first year at school, just after Christmas 1960. I was then taken to the Palace of Westminster, where I was brought to the old Free Church of Scotland. I never finished high school, but my life was quite extraordinary. When I arrived at Great Yarmouth on my birthday, I was greeted by about a dozen adults. Every 4 or 5 metres, we had to go a short distance and stand in a line. There would be 2 or 3 of us running ahead of us at about 5 or 10 paces. These lined-up youngsters called us the loons because, although they may not look it, they were also keen to run ahead. They never stopped for any adult. One day, we stopped for one of them, and he suddenly started screaming. But he seemed to be the only one. I didn't say anything, because it wasn't my place to understand or to get involved in that type of thing. It seemed so innocent and harmless to me. We then got dropped off at our home, which I guess was the right name. The reception there was terribly rude. They wouldn't allow us to give one of our sacks of sugar or milk to any of the schoolboys, or even to place a book of earth wisdom with a child's name on it. It was a familiar expression. One day, as we were saying our thanks to the masters who were there to offer us prizes and cards, another boy started shouting, "You bastards! You bloody fucking bastards!" I took it as a challenge and I said to him, "Why don't you try and show me?" He took a chunk of my chocolate, put it into his pocket, took out a gun and shot himself. That was a very, very bad year. Just awful.
A Troubled Dream. Drip, Drip, Drop by Rachel Ricks Moore. It's happening again. The faint sound of dripping. Drip, drip, drop. Echoes from the cold and damp hollow stone. How long have I been here? Again and again. I see the bunny in the distance on the hillside, the green silhouette moulded on the tree. Aside from the drip, drip, drip of the drip, 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 there is no one around. There is no sound. Suddenly, there's a voice from the underground speaking about the brilliant wizard of Zigton, and the music is playing upside down, accompanied by the voice from the underground. Sirens from another world merge into this one. Everybody looks like someone else. Have I been here before in this disco corridor? Each door has the initial JC on it. 23 doors of JC. Not sure what will be behind them. I can hear the whistling of Jiminy Cricket, wishing upon a very distant wandering star. Like a radio gone wrong, crackling out My Lighthouse by Pulp and then crackling back into Wishing Upon a Star. At the end of this disco corridor is a round set of standing stones with a large hole in the middle containing an empty cone. Julie Christie is sitting next to the gaping hole. Her eyes are closed and she dreams of days gone by. Approaching the hole, the cone grows larger and a tiny Julius Caesar peers up into my soul. A little soul crackles on the radio, blocking out any sunspots that are trying to get through. Faint chanting can be heard in the opposite direction. Someone telling me not to turn left. I hear the Seventh Nation crying out in the wilderness for its army long lost. A massive tank knocks down a wall and K2 arrives with hand grenades for all.
Under, Before by Toby Berryman. 29th April 1960, my seventh birthday. 2,557 days of William Ernest Drummond. A mere 84 months since I caused the first ripple in Galloway's Black Loch, but from Butterworth. There will be thousands more days, plenty more stones skimmed across the still dark waters before 2023. But for now, Newton Stewart in Galloway, not yet Corby, not yet Liverpool, and definitely not yet Moo Moo. There remained records to be made, moratoriums to be held, books, pamphlets, and pyramids to be produced, but little of this troubled the mind of 7-year-old Bill. A trifling 10% of my true life lived, but a great depth of the dark subconsciousness of my life already explored. There truly is a great innocence to pure youth, a naivety that allowed me to remain at one with my thoughts, and a blissful ignorance that never shattered a staggering self-belief. But yet, 7 was not the dream that I sometimes remember it as. It is not the joyous childhood, the convivial days amongst rural Scottish hills, the exhilaration of a life still ahead of you. 7 is a turning point, a watershed. 7 is a real birth, where the dark subconsciousness assumes the pleasantries of childhood. By 7, Mozart had begun composing. Shirley Temple had won her first Academy Award, but Bill Drummond remained captivated by the still waters of the Black Loch. Life's caesura allured me as I tossed the first stone into the dark water and paused, drawn by contemplation. There is a powerless quality to life itself. The ripples fade, and the water remains not yours. And yet, 7 stays as the crux. As I sat and stared across deathly still waters, I was overwhelmed for the first time, drowned by a contemplative recurring dream state that would pervade my adult life. 7 is not childhood. 7 is not adulthood. I spent my birthday sat there, cross-legged, as in school, a lone figure. I became part of nature. I had had an epiphany. I felt beyond fun, beyond kids, as though the facade of childhood had been lifted right in front of my eyes. It was the first time that I had truly felt alone, unique in the knowledge of an experience which felt solely mine. I had realized that my toys were not actually speaking to me when I played with Mum. I knew that they would never speak to me again. and I bawled my eyes out into them in the corner of my bedroom one night. The small blue bear that was by my bedside at birth, whose narrative and backstory had been formed for years, now sat mute and unloved atop my cupboard. I was devastated, distressed, isolated. At 7, there was no more Father Christmas and carrots left out for the reindeer, no more Easter bunny and egg trails around the garden, no more tooth fairy and pocket money inflation. I grew skeptical about fairy tales. The sweet taste of sugar now felt sickly. I was no longer scared of the dark, of the monster under my bed. My eyes had been opened to the realities of life, from the Cold War to the Greensboro sit-ins. Censorship does many children many favours, but I had taken that irreversible step into the harsh world. I remained there, legs crossed, arms folded, a boulder on the banks of the loch. I had moved past the presents, blowing out candles and parties at home. My childhood was slipping away from me, and unnervingly, I felt pleasantly comfortable with this. I was substantially underwhelmed by the feeling of my first cigarette, by the terrible taste of my peer-pressured first beer. I longed for nothing more than the respect, maturity, and freedoms of adulthood. But I was far too young to receive these. I struggled to come to terms with parental power, but I was not yet self-sustaining. 7 brought with it bewilderment, and I had hoped that the loch would provide answers. It did not. But the contemplation which it enabled has spurned a life of mindfulness and vocal confidence for which I am grateful. I feel somewhat for 7-year-old Bill, lost at the Black Loch with only his thoughts. But despite this, these thoughts have never ceased, and I still do ponder the fleeting powerlessness of a life well lived. Maybe Descartes' cogito ergo sum truly does stand the test of time, but in my own intellectual infancy, I was not to know this.